You mentioned Beirut.
Yep.
It just twigs the thought of how many countries have you installed?
Oh, yeah, good question.
But clearly,
lots.
15, 20,
25,
30.
Oh, 30
to 40. Is that
right? Yeah, something like
that. Wow.
I mean, it's basically a lot of Europe, some of the US. South America, we did some work a while ago.
Yep.
I think there's something in Afghanistan, I don't know. I know that Russia, there's a few bits.
Yeah, okay.
That was a while ago. Through Europe and Germany and Norway. Norway's been a good customer of ours.
Wow.
Yeah, and the UK.
That's
Canada is a bit.
Congratulations.
And China,
I mean,
is
super
Hong
impressive.
Kong, Japan, yeah.
Welcome back to Not an Audiophile. This is episode 43, season 2. Today's a big one. Yes, a longer episode, but we also move sideways into home cinema and commercial cinema. I mean, mostly home cinema as far as the discussion of actual products. But of course, Cricks Loudspeakers, Scott Cricks, been in business for 50 years, has in that time built an awful lot of commercial cinema loudspeakers as well as home audio equipment. Scott tells us all about that. While we were both visiting the Australian International Movie Convention on the Gold Coast recently, it's a slightly rambling interview, but I enjoyed it. He enjoyed it. I think you will too. And while I have you, of course, I request that if you are enjoying the podcast, to follow on your preferred platform, like us on YouTube, subscribe to our YouTube channel. We don't put up an enormous amount of YouTube videos, but of course every episode goes up as an audio-only video and you can grab them there as well. And of course that's where you can comment and we'd love to hear your comments, good, bad or otherwise. Thank you. For the discerning audio enthusiast, performance and precision matter. That's why March Audio employs Purify technology to engineer award-winning loudspeakers and amplifiers. They deliver sound that truly transcends expectations, all available at an entirely modest cost. Go now to marchaudio.com and check out more of Alan March's engineering feats, including a sale price on the 501 amplifier. March Audio, for the discerning audio enthusiast.
We're here today with Scott Cricks, yeah. And it's an absolute pleasure.
Oh.
Thank you for making time
yep.
away from the heavy schedule that you have at the Australian International Movie Convention on the Gold Coast 2025. Yeah. We have busted in
yep.
with your assistance to speak with you.
Yeah.
We've been wanting to speak to you for a while.
Yep.
You've been in the loudspeaker manufacturing business for a few years now.
Yeah. We started last Christmas. it was good that it took quite a long time for our people and your people to actually organise this prestigious event.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, my people, what you
months
mean?
And
you
months
mean Brad?
yeah, Brad. months and
he
months of negotiation.
Moves in mysterious ways.
Oh, yeah, that's right. It's casual, the bureaucracy that goes with
the
it.
The bureaucracy, is that what we call it? it's not what I always call it, but and look, we did speak briefly in Melbourne at the other famous event, industry event, so you're in multiple industries, so you have to go to more industry events than I ever have, but the other end, of course, was the StereoNet Australian Hi-Fi Show Melbourne version 2025 as well. You had an interesting display there.
Yes.
For those who are into hi-fi, and here, I haven't seen what you're up to here, but of course this is a commercial cinema and film production distribution convention.
Yep, that's right, yep.
Which you're, or have always, been involved with. Is
that's
that right?
Yep, it was since 1979, as a matter of fact.
Is that when you stepped sideways into commercial?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That's right. Well, what had happened is that I had a hi-fi shop called the Acoustic Foundry on King William Road.
It's kind of a good name, actually. I like that.
Some people call it the Autistic Foundry. Oh, we did. But anyway, it was a lot of fun, and I built these speakers when I was at uni in the early 70s, stuck them in the front window.
Okay.
And the proprietor for the cinema walked past and said, we need to upgrade the sound on the Capri Cinema and on Goodwood Road in Adelaide. So I went down there and they had three Ardens sitting on the floor, Tannoy Ardens, right?
Yes.
So it's not going to work in 1,000 No, not going to work. So anyway, so I built these really large dual 15-inch rear horn-loaded speakers with HF and all that sort of stuff.
Okay.
So it was sort of PA stuff, and I'd never really done it before, but I knew.
So a twin. So what? So a W bin.
No, it's not quite a W bin. A couple of 15s with the rear.
Oh, so side. Okay.
And you know that was direct radiating, but yes. The rear was horn loaded.
Okay.
So it was sort of a bit of a labyrinth and a fairly big mouth at the front. You know, I've never built one before, but I thought, well, that's all right.
Theoretically, it was going to work. Yep.
Yes. Because I did built some exponential horns in my earlier days.
Mm-hmm.
So. Anyway, that worked, but the problem there was an acoustic issue with the cinema itself
when
they came to equalise it. And what it was, as I found out, was actually the reflection from the speakers when it radiates to the rear wall.
Yeah.
And then re-reflects back into the auditorium.
Okay.
And you get a cancellation and reinforcement effect, or combing, or that something of that ilk.
Indeed, yeah.
So I built this partition.
For the rear wall, yeah. Oh, behind the screen.
Yeah, just behind the screen, put a wall.
Okay.
And some absorptive material, you know, so the speakers poke through it. And that was what we call the infinite baffle.
Which is interesting because clearly for those who are familiar with your current home cinema lineup,
yep.
You have what I call the wall of sound, which you may call the wall of sound as well. And maybe that's where I got it from, but it is literally a wall of sound.
Yeah,
you have an acoustically transparent screen like a commercial cinema.
Yep.
And with literally just your left, centre and right speakers and subs, I guess.
And subs poking through it.
Poking through it, right.
So that's carried through. And from that, Greater Union got interested because it was a bit of new technology.
Mm-hmm.
And we got all the business in Australia, essentially.
So that's interesting.
In the 80s.
So, through the 80s.
Yeah, we were busy for a good 5-10 years.
Is that right?
Yeah, all the multiplexes.
The start of that the multiplex.
Boom. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So we basically went all over the country and built them.
Huh, okay.
Yeah, we sort of had a pretty well monopoly on it. And we knew how to do it too. We sorted it all out and we had the manufacturing facility.
And probably the big difference, as I understand it from an outsider in regard to Crix, is that you, unlike so many loudspeaker makers, have your own... factory, cabinet making facilities.
Yep.
I mean, you have your own factory, of course, but to make crossovers and what have you, and assemble the enclosures, but make the enclosures.
That's right. I'm sorry, I'm just...
it's not your phone. I think there's someone on the radio outside.
I just want to make it silent.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
I guess you're right. Actually, mine's not on silent either. Yeah. This is a very casual interview.
Yeah, by the way, would you like coffee?
I have this water
that
I found earlier.
Sorry, what were you saying?
Well, I mean, you're saying you had a monopoly because you made whatever you wanted.
Pretty much.
Guess you could customise to some degree once again. Yeah,
we did. What had happened is that we actually built the boxes, and all the stuff and all the bracketing and everything at work, and then we'd ship it. But we built these things in such a way that we could install it really easily.
Yes.
You know, you do the first one and you think, well, geez, how do you do it differently?
Yeah.
And then you come up with something on the job and then you get back to the factory and say, well, we'll build the boxes in a certain way.
Yes.
And it's interesting that the exhibitors supplied us with the drivers and they preferred our boxes because they were a bit more substantial. And we built
those. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yeah, we built them pretty big.
Well, they were as sturdy as they should be.
Yeah, and then I ended up having to make... They wanted me to make a decision as to what brand that we should use.
As far as drive units go.
Drive units the technology, and I thought, yeah. And, you know, we went and did all the due diligence on all of them, and so we ended up chose a brand, and we worked with it for as long as we needed to.
Yeah, okay. You know?
And then eventually we developed our own horns and bass drivers and all that sort of stuff in time. But, you know, we were using that. We build the boxes... and put all the drivers in, and then we built in such a way that you could actually assemble them on site. Because this was on a building site, and a building site's pretty aggressive.
Yeah, this wasn't retro.
That's
commercial
aggressive.
Building sites are.
It's interesting stuff when you get when you get the right police around. It's a bit of a challenge.
Because this was all kind of this, like you say, was the new wave of multiplex cinemas. Yep. These were new builds. These were not retrofits of old clunky cinemas. One screen type complexes. Shopping centre type.
That's exactly right. Well, like Pacific Fair. We didn't do Pac Fair, but Maribyrnong and places in Melbourne and Sydney and Perth and Brisbane here and a place like that. We did a lot of all those.
And at some point, you made a move into Southeast Asia, or...?
Yes, yeah. Well, what happened is that Greater Union and its Edge or whatever its various forms were, they moved into Southeast Asia in Singapore. So our products went up there. We didn't do the installs.
No.
But our products went up there with it. It went to the Middle East.
Okay.
Because they had a branch there.
Yeah.
And in India.
That's interesting that
that was back in the 80s.
They expanded, you
we went with
tagged
them.
Along, and they well clearly that happy with the product.
We delivered on time. We were actually
we did.
The funny thing is
it's a good start, right?
We'd get on site and they'd say, "You're okay. Well, you're a bit late." So yeah, okay.
What, 7 minutes?
Yeah, something like that. You should have been here a couple of days ago. Where are you? And then a few days later, we've done about four screens in 3 to 4 days.
Because of your
ease. We just know how to do it.
Yes.
Yep. And then they say, well, Jesus, you're a bit bloody quick, aren't you? Because we're not finished.
we're not ready for you.
Because we want to get out and
we've
got another
complain.
Job. So we'll say, well, you either finish it or we're walking off the job. That's not going to work. So, the guys that employed us, they knew what we were like.
Yeah.
They knew that they'd get done. Always be there on the day, and we'll always have all the freights already organised. We know how to get it into the cinemas, and all the nuts and bolts of getting it, the engineering was done. And that was where we got our reputation from in this industry.
In the Scott Crick's book of how to run a business.
Yeah, righto. Yeah.
Turning up more or less on time, but then once you're there.
Yep.
Having a system in place where you can just power on and get a lot done in a small, which of course is on-site, is very important.
Yeah. Essentially, our employer, we contracted to, like Edge or Greater Union, whatever form it was, they knew when we were turning up.
Yep.
But we'll be there Monday at 7 o'clock in the morning, and the truck will roll up about 10, and we'll be unloading it. It's got to go into the cinemas, and we were there with five of us, the A team as we called it. We had a B team, because we'd get that site sorted out, and then I'd follow it off with the B team, and then we'd prep the next site.
Okay,
because it was that busy,
So what? To put a number on it, ballpark number.
Yeah.
How many screens?
Well, I think it was a good couple of hundred we did.
Wow. Okay.
Something like that.
Yep.
Oh, we're all over the country. Somebody rang me. I was in Perth. Somebody rang me, all the cinemas inside looked the same, right? So he rang me and said, "Where are you, Scott?" Because I had one of the first mobile phones.
It
was basically
like
car battery.
A brief, car battery.
It was a transceiver.
Yes, well, yeah, that's right. It was like
an analog version.
Something you'd have out in the outback, that had like a radio phone.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's what it was.
Battery. That's in the late 80s kind of thing.
That's right, late 80s, early 90s, but But anyway, somebody rang up and said, "Where are you, Scott?" I said, "Look around." Oh, fuck.
I'm not sure.
So it sort of got like that, But, it put us on the map, really.
So
we built a factory out of it.
So this is... So we don't need to pin down exact... the whole... the history is very interesting, I think, to a lot of people.
It's amazing what
but we'll also talk about what's happening now. But, your 50th anniversary was last year.
Yeah.
So what do you regard as the beginning? Is that your first pair of loudspeakers you put into the store that you...
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Yeah.
Is that, or was that the... it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
It's when you started, but...
Yeah.
But at some point... how do you feel about hi-fi versus cinema, I think is what I'm trying to say. And then when I say cinema, I mean commercial and home cinema, because you do all three segments.
Yep.
I get the feeling that certainly in the 80s, the commercial cinema was what was really the motive. It was where the money was. Yep. That's how you were going to pay for a factory, right?
That's basically how it worked,
So, but the hi-fi was your first love?
Yes.
You meant to say yes for this podcast. It's
yes.
Yes.
Yes, yes, it was. But and that was a big yes. This happened when I was in high school.
Yeah, okay.
You know,
yeah.
In my mid-teens, I built a 10-watt valve amplifier.
Okay.
Yeah, mono, from a set of plans that...
So a fairly grunty one for the day.
Yeah, really. Mate, it was the biggest amp in the biggest amp in the village.
And the village, we should mention, is some part of Adelaide.
It's
presumably.
Loxton.
Yes.
Out okay. in the middle of nowhere.
Is that right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. This was on the River Murray. Right?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and my father was a soldier settler.
Okay.
So he had a fruit block.
Ah, yeah.
So
yeah,
we're okay. out in the middle of the sticks.
Yeah, they you give know? You, yes. Yeah,
we didn't have streetlights.
Valueless land.
Yeah.
You're
yeah,
supposed to make a go of it.
That's yeah. basically how it works yeah. in a lot of water. You know, you yeah. just pump it up and you shove it on.
Well, yes. Yeah. So you had access to the river.
Yeah,
yes,
that's yeah. right. Yeah, that was all sort of done for us. And so that's how, I mean, essentially, you know, I learned a lot of mechanics because
mm-hmm.
that's what I used to do as a kid. I did a lot of excavation because I liked mining. Tunneling.
It's like tunneling.
Yeah, that's
a bit of it. I like to build a good tunnel.
Yeah, I liked a good tunnel. The only problem is I ran into the water table, and that was a bit of a problem.
Okay.
Because well, of the fall in.
Makes it difficult to navigate the tunnel
yeah,
at that point.
Exactly right. So, welding, mechanics, okay. electronics, wine. I made wine, you know, because the old man was growing grapes, and he saved okay. some for me in a couple of years. He said, oh, here, I'll give you leave a couple of vines for you and we'll pick the fruit and we'll squash it and make some plonk out of it.
Do you remember what variety?
Shiraz.
Is that right? Of course it was.
Of course. What yes. else is there?
In SA, what else could it be?
There's Shiraz and there's all the others.
Wow. Yeah. So that's so how was the wine?
No.
No. There was some subtle flaws.
Some. I did learn something. I matured some and fermented some in a sealed plastic container.
Mm-hmm.
It was a 20-litre
container. A sealed plastic container?
Yeah, it had a bubbly bit and all that, sort of, all that good stuff.
A vent, so to speak. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And I did it in an old keg.
Mm.
The old keg didn't work because it was an old keg and it was full of Brettanomyces.
Yes, yes.
And
so that was off like...
Yeah, it was deep house. Yes, yeah. But the one in the plastic was good.
Well, yeah, if you've cleaned it nicely yeah, before you...
Yeah, put a metabisulfate yes, in and all yes, the good stuff yeah. in. And it was really a lot of fun when you had to rack it off because it was all suction. You know, one for me and one for the flagon. And, but it didn't work. It was okay. But it was a lot of fun doing it. I built this chipboard box and lined it with wax and we shoveled the grapes in it and we'd take our shoes and socks off.
Yep.
Squashy, squashy, squashy.
So that was the, that was the squashing
right,
process.
Back lawn, no problem.
Yep.
Yep, so it was great. We all got in and out of go.
I guess the cleanliness is not relevant until you get to the fermentation
That's
stage.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yep. Well, God only knows what was in there, but we did yes. put a yeast into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we put the metabisulfate in, killed the yeast off as best we could, didn't measure it much and just shoved the poly yeast in. And it was interesting because once I had a keg full, and the yeast I put in was stuck. So the old man went out to the winery and got something out of the winery, fermenting tank,
yep.
shoved it in.
Started it up again.
Started it up, and he said about 2 days later, the thing just stopped. Oh! Bloody wine all over the back for him.
Oh, really? Slightly too vigorous.
It was sort of pretty vigorous,
yes. There's sugars left, obviously, so...
Yeah, yeah.
Have you... In more modern eras, made some wine that you're...
I have made the odd bit with people that know what they're doing. You know, people that... Their pay grade is a lot higher than mine, put it that way.
For those listening outside of the country, yep. although I think the Australian wine industry is quite well known worldwide by people who know
definitely.
Wine.
Yep, yeah.
But yes, Scott hails from the... What would popularly be regarded as the hub of Australian quality, high-end Australian winemaking.
Oh, you say the right things.
Well,
you should be a marketing man.
I've tried, but I'm not that good. It really is though, isn't it? I mean,
pretty much.
The amount of grapes
yep.
grown and wine made, yeah. I don't know the exact numbers, and I mean, I guess the hunter always thinks that it's important, but I mean, everyone I speak to in wine says, you know, the hunter's a joke, and you know, it's all about Well, all of the areas of SA. I don't think there's any one. I mean, obviously the Barossa is perhaps regarded as the I feel like historically, but McLaren Vale and the hills.
McLaren Vale, the hills, Coonawarra, Clare, they're all really important. They're just different. I mean, McLaren Vale, I'm from the McLaren Vale area, and we think we're much better than the Barossa. And the Barossa wonders who we are. But I love the Barossa. I love the history of the Barossa.
The history's amazing.
Oh, yeah, and what's going on up there, and also in the McLaren Vale, is just different. And the people are a little bit different. They're a little bit more boutique-y, you could say. Barossa's probably a little bit bigger and probably got the weight of history.
Yeah, McLaren Vale's a bit more boutique-y.
Yeah, I think so. And it's a little bit different style. So it's just nice. I like it.
Yeah, it's an amazing culture, I guess.
It is.
No pun intended.
No.
Just step back to hi-fi for a second, rather than my preferred subject. It is a little early in the morning for probably...
Should have brought a bottle, huh?
Yeah, well, it's nearly lunchtime. I guess from the point of view of the podcast, we want to talk a little bit about hi-fi. Hi-fi is what got you started.
That's exactly right.
You mentioned the instance where the gentleman for the local cinema...
Yep, John.
Saw
John Harvey.
John Harvey.
Yep.
Saw your the fact that you could make a loudspeaker.
Yep. Yep.
And he needed someone to create something other than these tannoys that he had kicking around. Yeah. I hardly imagine he had them kicking around. I mean, is that what was in there? Or
that was behind the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. It was a stage, if you like, because an organ society owned it.
Yep.
It was quite an interesting combination, but they had the screen, and just behind it there were three Ardens, tannoy Ardens, on the ground. And how the hell anybody could listen to that?
I guess this is... I mean, you know... It was a while ago. It was a few years ago, and it was a different time. People sometimes forget. Plus, it was Adelaide.
Yeah. As I say, you can come back to Adelaide in 20 years, and nothing's changed.
Well, I get that, of course, being a Queenslander, it's the old joke, you know, because we don't have daylight savings that we're a year, we're an hour behind, but. 20 years and 1 hour, but
I don't know what you're saving with daylight saving. Where's the saving? I've still haven't worked that
out. I've never worked it out either.
I've pondered that for many
years. So it's weird because the time of the year where you do naturally get more late afternoon, early evening light, we want even more of it.
Yeah.
Shouldn't daylight saving be in winter?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Why don't we start it 2 hours earlier?
Well, it is a thing that...
I mean, it's dark all the time.
The days are longer. The daylight hours are longer. Yeah. The days, I think, are still exactly 24 hours, but...
I've heard that.
Yes, but we want even more daylight.
Yeah.
So South Australia not doing daylight saving?
Yeah, they do. We've been doing it for a long time.
So you've got it at the moment?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we're half ahead of you guys now.
You would be, yes, because you've got that weird time zone.
Yeah, we've got a half an hour thing.
Yeah, which is actually on a worldwide basis fairly unusual.
Yeah, it is.
There's lots of unusual things in South Australia.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We won't go into details, right?
Well, we will in a second. We'll have a quick break.
Oh, okay.
Because we've got to play an ad, right?
Oh, yeah, right. Eh?
This is how we make our money, in theory.
Okay, fair enough.
Back in a sec, folks.
Are you familiar with Edgar Kramer? Well, you should be. He's Australia's most renowned hi-fi reviewer. And his website, soundstageaustralia.com, is, well, quite amazing. Incredibly detailed, well-written reviews on all sorts of interesting hi-fi components, interviews with industry luminaries, factory tours, and, of course, news. Don't forget, Soundstage Australia is part of Soundstage Global Network. So when you're finished with this podcast, go to soundstageaustralia.com and check it out.
We're back, part two. It may not be part two. We're back.
But part 1A.
Scott Cricks. Yeah, well, we don't know what segment of the show it is, but I mean, the laziness of the editing of Not an Audiophile podcast means that it's almost certainly part two.
Yeah, okay.
Just because
now we've defined
cut it.
Cut
it and shut it. Hey, we're at the movie industry convention at the Gold Coast. Bumped into Scott.
Yep.
Mainly because we planned it months before. So We've established that the business started in 74.
That's right.
Now, your brothers have some involvement in the business. Did you rope them in or something?
I don't know about rope, but they were sort of interested.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I've always been interested in T-Channel. I really got into it when I was at high school.
Well, we were talking about that 10-watt amplifier. Let's finish
That mega amplifier.
Which was in the 70s, obviously.
Yes, it was early 70s. Yes. Actually, 60s, sorry.
Oh, bloody hell. Okay. Yeah. You don't look that old, but anyhow.
Yeah, that was an interesting story in itself. Because I had to build it three times, didn't work the first time, as you do. I learned about parasitic oscillation.
Did you learn about smoke and...
Oh, not so much smoke. I noticed that you don't put your fingers across a 300-volt rail,
so that wasn't
a good idea.
Yeah.
Don't do it twice.
300 volts DC is quite... It's stingy.
It is. It's smoky.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Not when you show somebody this is how you did it and you do it again.
You shouldn't do that.
That was a bad idea.
No,
I don't recommend that. Viewers, do not attempt this at home.
No, it's electrocution is... I mean, it gets you going.
It does.
It livens you up.
Oh, yeah. It teaches you.
AC is more effective at that than DC in the way that it gets you vibrating at about 50 times a second.
Yes, it probably wakes me up. So
the amplifier got built eventually.
Yeah, built some speakers.
Mm-hmm.
All I could find at Loxton was a 12-inch twin cone. I can't remember the brand of it, but I built that. It was pretty ordinary. And then we went to Sydney, and I found a Ditton 15 Celestion, which I still have. I still have the amplifier that I built.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The 10-watter.
Yeah.
Yeah, rightio.
Oh, yeah.
Is this in the Crick's factory at the works?
Yes, it is the Crick's factory.
I mean, the Crick's museum, I should say.
Yeah, it was definitely a museum, that's for sure. Yeah, we've got everything that we've built over the last 50 years.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Well, you sort of don't know your future, but if you have to know your future, you have to know your past.
Okay.
And you need to have all that. And also, if you bring it out and you look at what you've done and how successful and all that sort of stuff, or otherwise, you can see where things are. But it's also because, the next generation might want to know what you've been doing.
There is that, because 50 years is a bloody long time. I think when you're, 55 or however old you are now, because you started at a very early age.
54, I was 4, wouldn't you
say? You must look back yourself and go, it's an incredible progression. I mean, the thing is, you've done it non-stop as well.
That's right.
So there's something from every year, I guess.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm. Well, the first commercial ones, when I sort of registered the business and was sort of semi-registered, but sort of start to do it full-time.
As registered as it needed to be in 1974.
Yes, unregistered. I built the LF ones, the lo-fi ones. It was an 8-inch Plessy two-way with a cone tweeter.
Yeah, yeah.
And an 8-inch bass driver. Very proud of that. It's still kicking around.
Okay.
And they went to the Norton's chemist at Loxton, and they won't sell them back to me.
Is that right?
I've got the second pair. I think it was second or third pair. But I built them out of solid walnut.
Solid,
okay. Yeah, I found this was when I was in Adelaide.
A time when timber was less expensive.
That's right. Yes. Anyway, we've got them in the R&D room.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, we
the
had
second
tweeter.
Pair.
Yeah, number two.
Now, do they have a certain charm?
Yeah, they do.
Because I'm on this.
That's very vintage. I'll tell you what. You want vintage? We got vintage.
Cone tweeters. They're probably not ideal at the very higher frequencies, but
they're not.
You do end up with a directionally probably a nicer blending, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it's a pretty wide dispersion pattern at lower frequencies. It probably handles the lower frequencies better.
You can cross it over lower. And with, I guess, less steep filters.
That's right.
Yeah. In fact, probably the fashion really dictated then that you've really just got first order filters on it, I would presume.
I think it was a second order.
Or maybe on the tweeter.
Yeah, but I didn't really do much of the impedance checking on it. Didn't have the tech then.
I was going to say, what would you have done that with?
Well, all it was, I mean, was just mathematical stuff.
Yeah, you would have had to have, you know, had an audio generator and...
Yep, that's it.
Measure it and chart it. And what a pain in the ass, considering what we do. We press one button now and seconds later...
Yeah, it's all sorted.
Yeah,
it's... pretty much.
Yeah.
And you can do your simulations, but one of the things I did learn at uni is how powerful simulations are.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can move along really quickly.
Yes.
With sims.
Rather than building and measuring.
Yeah. I mean, we used to do the building and measuring, and then we found that technology moved in that area. I mean, we didn't invent it all, but, you know, we sort of took use of it when we could.
Yeah.
And that's how we sort of got into the building horns and speaker boxes and all that sort of stuff. You sim it, and then you test it.
Well, horns particularly, I guess, with the simming, because building a horn and then measuring it and finding it's crap is an enormous waste of energy.
Yes. Well, what had happened is that we got this guy, Dave Murphy. He's a very senior, very good mathematician,
mm-hmm.
was a lecturer at TAFE.
Yes.
Engineer, et cetera, et cetera. And he was, like I said, very good at his maths. And he started on MathCAD.
Yep.
And we designed our horns from there.
Okay.
And then we'd cut it all out using a CNC machine.
Yes.
And then we'd have to build the profile.
Yeah.
And that was carbog.
Yeah, okay.
And yours truly had put his hand up to do all that. But anyway, it took us about 2 or 3 weeks to do an iteration.
Use the plug effectively version of the horn, and then you could ultimately pull a mould off that and create
clones. Yeah, then you
clones.
take that's exactly how we did it.
You've historically been building horns out of fiberglass or
early days.
It's the way to do it though, right?
So that's we managed to get something reasonable early on in the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were fortunate enough we applied for a grant, an R&D grant, to help with this.
Yep.
And that made a huge difference to us. So we got ANSYS, which is a final element analysis package.
Yes.
Spent a fortune on computing and all that sort of stuff.
So what year is this, Scott, approximately?
Oh, this would be in the late 80s, I reckon.
Oh, wow.
Early 90s, I think, something like that.
It's pretty early days for that sort of thing.
Yep. But the package and the computing is, I mean, what you can buy now and what you could buy then was enormously
different. Well, a powerful computer then was 20K or something.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what it would cost us, 20, 30 grand.
Yeah.
So, you know, we do, and we spend two years writing software in ANSYS as acoustic software. And then we had to verify it.
Yeah.
And we'd model the compression driver. And we verify it by putting in vacuum.
Okay.
And this was an associate of Adelaide Uni.
Right, yeah.
So we did it with the mechanics department.
Okay.
So there was this, we had a guy that was doing his PhD, was doing it with us.
Yeah.
And he did his PhD on certain elements of horn design.
Okay.
And it's quite an interesting PhD, but he did it with us and with Dave Murphy. Dave knows loudspeakers really well, and he understands this FEA.
Yes.
And we've got to a stage now that he can do a prototype, and if we're happy with it, with the results, we can go straight to production.
Wow.
We'd usually print it just to make sure it's right.
Yes.
And then we do all the various off-axis measurements and all that sort of stuff.
So print it as in 3D
printing.
Print. Yeah. How big a horn are we?
Oh, something about that size. You can do it in pieces and glue it together.
Yeah, I guess so. So about you're saying about a foot by a foot, or 30 centimetres, 25, 30 centimetres.
You know, often if it's big enough, you just do half of it and you glue it together, or even in quarters. You do the, you know, you've got a horn that's looking sideways, you chop it in half, and you've got the first part of it. Because a horn, essentially, a constant directivity horn is actually two horns. And there's the first part.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it does a lot of the vertical and horizontal dispersion. Yeah. Then you glue another one on it, which does the other plane.
Yeah, okay.
So you have this slit. You've seen a CD horn. You have
slit.
And then you have the opening.
Yes.
The flary
horns,
bit.
Horns are a mystery to me in a way.
They are an absolute black science. They're not a black art.
Yes.
They're not a black art, but they are. You know.
There's a lot of science, but...
Yep.
To get it to sound nice,
yep.
I mean, I guess that's the trick of speakers is to,
yeah.
You can, there's, I mean, you know better than anyone probably, you can measure the perfect loudspeaker and go, wow,
yeah.
Look at that.
Yeah.
Now let's have a listen to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh crikey, let's start again.
Yeah.
It's kind of annoying in a way.
Yep.
There's sort of a, and then the, I always think of those brands out there that just make lovely sounding loudspeakers. Those people clearly understand,
yep.
As you clearly do, particularly when it comes to horns.
Yep.
Although I've heard your bigger systems, home cinema systems, at shows, yep. And things, and
yep.
They do all frequency ranges very nicely. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm sort of alluding to subwoofers there to a degree, but there is a bit of a black art in there somewhere with speakers, where just knowing how, just the I don't know, there's a certain touch to getting the music to come forth.
Yeah.
And I think that's where some brands clearly ultimately do better than others. We're skipping sideways a little bit, but it comes to mind to, there's two things we want to talk about your brothers, but the connection in later years, or I don't know at what point, I mean, home cinema at some point took off.
Yes.
And you had the commercial cinema background.
Yep.
You must have looked at that and gone.
Yep.
Did this happen when DVD kind of,
yeah,
and Dolby Digital came out, or was it?
I think in the 90s.
That would be the late 90s, but did you start earlier 90s or Prologic days? Or?
Home theatre.
Yes.
I can't remember.
Well, it's a while ago.
Yeah, I think it was in its 90s. But we produced some of the drivers that we got out of the cinema business.
Ooh.
You know, we sourced a whole heap of stuff. And then we found out that some of it we could use for center, the left and rights on home theatre.
Yes.
It's basically home cinema was a TV set with left and right in the centre.
Yeah.
You know, that was basically maybe a surround or two. Not many projectors and screens. Not that we were involved in anyway at the time, because that was pretty expensive. But we had this 8-inch two ways, which was really successful as a left and right because it had that really big, rich bottom end.
Yes.
And, you know, when it was efficient, the 4-ohm bass driver.
Yep.
You know, and it pushed the bottom end nicely.
Yep, yes.
And then the centre channel, this was an interesting one because a lot of people stick this really tiny little box on top of the TV.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, that's just crazy because the centre channel's the most important.
It's the most important one.
Yeah. So we said, well, okay, that's crazy. What's the most popular TV, which was at the time was a 42-inch, I think it was. And they said, well, what's the width of it? So we built the centre that wide.
Yes.
And I said, oh, we better make sure it takes us the TV.
So the intention of putting the TV on the centre speaker.
Yeah, well, it's a bit better situated. You've got one up there, this scungy little thing that's tweet.
Yeah.
But you want something with a bit of bottom end.
Absolutely.
And clear mid.
Yes.
And all that sort of stuff. The real intelligibility part. I mean, the drivers are not optimally arranged.
No.
They're in a horizontal plane.
It's actually
The
thing with centre speakers is you want it to replicate, you want to have an LCR across the front, effectively, but the way it works with TVs, you kind of can't have it. So continue the story.
Time.
So you made it the right width, but you still had to put the drivers in a horizontal array, annoyingly.
We had to live with that. So we made sort of the crossover point was as low as possible. But
yes.
It was 6.5-inch, I think it was a 6.5, dual 6.5-inch two-way.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, to make sure it was suitable for purpose, we just put a ton of MDF on it.
Yep.
Got forklift, top it on. Yep, that's not going to fall apart.
No.
No worries there, it's going to hang in the weight because it was a bit new for us. And
we should point out TVs weighed a ton back then as well.
Yeah, they did.
Yes.
They were quite heavy.
Because you're talking 42-inch plasma, you're talking...
No, they're just...
A CRT, the biggest CRT ever made.
Yeah.
My God, they weighed 120 kilos.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We want to make sure it could cope with that. But the funny part about it, there was suddenly a lot of other brands that had exactly the same dimensions. So I thought, oh, well, fair enough. But I guess that's flattery.
Well, it kind of is.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they were really almost... I mean, centre speakers in the 90s were almost one or the other. They were either... There weren't that many huge ones, but you clearly had one and there were followers.
Yeah.
Or the other idea, of course, was to make the thing, like you say, so small that it presented less of a problem to locate. But
yes, exactly.
But they never worked.
No, not in our mind. And we also found that the response curve of the centre channel followed the X curve of cinema, which was basically flat to 2K and then the 3D roll off at 2K.
The Dolby curve or the...
The Dolby curve, the S curve, the two...
Yeah, what's it?
296.
What's the correct...
I think it's called the...
Naming of that roll off?
Well, it's actually is called the X curve, but it's also this 2969 curve.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I can't remember now.
I've forgotten.
But it's just printed in my head. But we found that that roll off actually sounded a lot better for a lot of stuff that was coming out for this content, you know.
Yeah, it's funny how... the content is mixed, I guess, flat, I guess, and then you're sort of tailoring it a little bit.
Yeah, we were adding some magic to it, I guess. The other thing, too, is that you've got a speaker and you've got a TV sitting on it. You've got a nice wall. You've got a little bit of loading.
Yes.
Thanks to the TV and probably the cabinet underneath, even though it might have holes in it. But
yeah, a little bit of infinite baffle.
A little bit of infinite baffle going on. So that was sort of made a little bit of difference to the bottom end.
Yeah, well, that would have richened it up a touch.
It did.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So that worked quite well. And we call it the Centrix. Funny about that. That took a lot of thought.
Well, your naming has always, I don't know what it is, but there's so often an IX in it.
Yeah, I don't know how that
what
happened.
What is that?
I don't know.
It's a natural progression, I guess. And I mean, you've been doing that. Did you do that from day one? Did you call it the X?
No, one of our guys.
Well, you had the LF for lo-fi, you were saying.
Yeah, lo-fi, medium-fi, and what was it?
Heaven forbid, the HF hi-fi?
No, we didn't do that.
Ultra.
There was a lot of F's in it.
I thought that was during the manufacturing process.
Exactly right. You know how I used to put the holes in for the speakers in the early days?
Well, there's only really two ways.
Yeah.
You're either going to drill a series of holes or
that's what I did. That's exactly what I did. And then I got to a router and I had a piece of board with a hole in it, a nail. You stick that in the board and twist it around. That was my manufacturing technique.
Well, the reality is, what else were you going to do in the 70s?
Well, absolutely
CNC
nothing.
CNC was a dream. Yeah. But speaking of CNC and manufacturing for a second, now, I mean, you guys have invested, as you mentioned, re the software and what have you.
Yep.
My understanding is you've got an amazing router these days, which there's probably not a whole lot of them there's none in the country used for loudspeaker making, that's for sure, except yours.
Probably not. Yeah, well, there's two of them.
Five-axis?
Yes, a five-axis machine.
So...
Two 5-axis machines.
You got two?
Oh, we got two.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you had one for a start, though.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And you were that impressed, and you obviously needed to up production or something.
Yeah. Well, sometimes you've just got to be careful. You've got to have two, because if one's not working, you've got a fallback.
Yeah.
You can't be offline.
No.
But then you can start to get picky about which machine you want to use, you know, because one's a later model than the other, you know, sort of thing.
So have you got different tooling programs for those, or are they?
Oh, yeah, we've got
you tend to tool certain things for one machine.
Well, you've got a choice of 20 or 30 different tools.
Yeah.
You know,
you've
sort of got, basically on the machine, you've got a range of tools you use, and then you've got another backup piece of saws and just about anything you think of.
People should, I'm pretty sure there's a video on your website.
Oh, they'll be around somewhere.
And even if it's not on Scott's website, and that's the place to look, though, because I've said it myself. The fact that the extra axes are the head tilts, basically.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And...
you should be in manufacturing, mate.
Yeah, well, I've only got a 3-axis machine.
Oh, right, okay.
Because, you know, I'm much smaller.
I can see jealousy coming.
I mean, there is a jealousy because, I mean, the creativity of your designs some degree limited by what you've got to build it with.
Yes,
you have that extra couple of domains that you can do interesting things with in an automated way where you don't have to create jigs or other things and move stuff around. So you had 3-axis machines back in the day.
Yes, that's right. In the earlier days we did all that.
Which, of course, would have been... I mean, I think it's an amazing tool. I mean,
absolutely.
The joy of people who are listening don't realise that Scott and I are the only two loudspeaker manufacturers in the country.
The only people crazy enough.
That have their own cabinet facility. Mine is in a very small shed in a corner, and the Crick's factory is hundreds of acres.
Yes, that's one shed.
If you include the vines. The point is that the joy of having an idea and being able to draw it up and prototype it same day is, for me, it's fun. For you, it's a huge competitive advantage.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, you obviously saw that early days.
Yeah.
And it's served you well, no doubt.
Absolutely.
How long ago did you buy your first five axis unit?
I can't.
So 10 years ago or something?
Oh, it'd be more than that.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay. It's probably three axis in the...
Well, three axis would be 90s, I guess.
Yeah, or something like that. I can't remember. Yeah. That's too many.
Do you have a preference for brand of machine?
Well, we've got a Morbidelli.
Yep.
We call it Morfordvale Deli. And a Biesi.
So you're a big fan of Italian machines?
Yeah, well, there's sort of not much of it. What else? I mean, you can get German machines, but these seem to fit the bill.
Yeah, they seem to be the two, historically, the two most popular.
We had to do a lot of changes to these machines to make them a little bit more operational.
Okay.
We need to do some engineering on it because some of the engineering wasn't as good as it should be, so we've had we've had to adapt it somewhat, unfortunately, but...
That's the Ferrari and the Maserati of the CNC woodworking routing machines.
Yeah.
They may need some.
Yes. Some of the engineering was as good as what we thought it could be.
So. How's the electrics?
Yeah, well, that was...
Or has that been okay?
Yeah, well, that's not too bad, but we had to change some of the few things on that too.
Okay.
I mean, we've got an electrical engineer on board.
Well, speaking of that, you've got all these tools.
Yeah.
And obviously you do your own painting.
Yep.
How many people are working there these days?
Oh, 30-ish. That's all up.
So, yeah.
Everybody.
So I asked how many people are working, though. About half?
Yeah, well, it's probably, you know, the people that are doing the manufacturing, that's probably two.
The real work.
No, actually, those guys are stores and all those
people. So 30 people?
Something like that.
That's...
It's been pretty stable like that.
Okay.
Yeah. And we've added a few more people recently, but those sort of young people that are... learning the trade, so to speak. So we hope they'll like to get involved with it and stay. So a lot of people have been there for 10, 20 years.
Which is fantastic. Yeah. So these people are a real asset to the business.
Oh, they're magic. Absolutely magic. Yeah. We've got a great bunch of people, really.
Yeah. Mm. It's what you need.
Yep.
And it was actually going to be one of my questions because it's... I guess when you get the business going, which you've been doing for many years... it gets a little easier. You get a certain momentum or an inertia from having some good people that you can spin. You know, you're then in a position to train more good people. And are you finding it okay to you're getting younger people interested? Are they? I mean, you say you've got a couple, but
is it a challenge?
It's a challenge.
Yeah. The discipline and all that sort of stuff is a challenge. But it's not impossible.
No.
But you've got to find the right people that are interested in a trade-based type of career.
Yes.
And it is a career. And we've got people that have sort of come, they've sort of not much of a background, but it's really, do you want to?
Yeah.
And you've got the headspace to do
that's right.
Things.
It's not.
And they've started to get involved.
You don't need to walk in there as a... cabinet maker as such.
We do a lot of that sort of
I mean, you've got the way you want to do it anyhow.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And obviously you build the boxes in such a way that less than trade level skills are required to put them together anyhow is the idea.
Well, a lot of the tradespeople, if you like, start to become technicians that can run the machines.
Yes.
And we would like them to get more involved in the maintenance.
Yep.
And the programming.
Yes.
That would be a nice step for a cabinet maker, if you like. Yep. So it becomes more of a technical role, building machines. And then, you know, some of our own department, they do a lot of the programming, but it's also how to put it together.
Yes.
And the tradespeople or our technicians have an input as to how this all should go together. You know, so it becomes more of a responsible role. You know, it's not just gluing things together, it's how you do it.
No. The tooling process and how to cut materials and so that, you know, and then, I mean, but then you do, obviously you've got draftsmen / designers on the premises.
We have two industrial design people on board.
Okay.
We wouldn't mind another one, to be quite frank.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Want to make your hobby your career? Hi-Fi businesses for sale. Stereotech and Delacord manufacturing award-winning loudspeakers, hi-fi furniture and acoustic treatments are established brands teetering on the edge of the next big step. The hard work has been done, markets and models established. Now it's your turn. See www.stereotech.com.au for more information.
So we were interrupted in our previous meeting room and a lawyer told us that we had to leave immediately.
Yes.
And of course, you know, we did.
Yeah, we did.
So we're now in the room next door, which is actually someone else's room, but there's no one here.
Yeah, thank God. Thanks,
so
Ed.
We're here semi-legally.
Yeah, that's right.
Scott knows the people that own this room, so
that's it.
Maybe we'll be okay.
Yeah, no, we'll be fine.
Yeah. So yeah, Atmos has been a boon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's as much in commercial as, as in home?
When it first came out, we first learned about it, now I can't remember how many years ago, it was here.
Okay.
It was released.
Yep.
And I got the white paper.
Yeah.
And there was a fair bit of misconceptions about it, so I read the whole lot while I was here.
Mm-hmm.
And then I defined what we needed speaker-wise.
Yes.
For it. But there wasn't any software or anything available at the time.
No.
So, you know, there's surround subwoofers and all that sort of stuff. So
when you say software, you mean there were no discs to play?
Yeah.
You know, it was no...
Yeah. No, it's just the engineering...
Oh, no engineering software.
Yeah, right. Now there's what we call the DART, which
just
plug the room dimensions and does it all for you.
Yeah, rightio.
But in the early days, nobody knew what to put in it.
Yes.
But I worked out what we needed at sound pressure level wise and the headroom and all that sort of stuff that they needed, and then defined the loudspeakers that we needed to use for it. And then the industry got in touch with us to work out what was required.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're speaker people, so we know the distance laws and all that sort of stuff and how much power you're going to need and what sort of headroom. And so we went through all that. So we used to consult to the industry in the early days.
Okay.
And, you know, we did it just basically on graph paper just about. But don't forget it's on the 3D situation.
Mm.
And you make a few allowances for, you know, make sure the efficiency is right and the room loading and all that sort of stuff. We make sure we had that under control. And then, you know, then it just evolved from that. But we did get quite a good leg up in the industry here in Australia because we had it really well sorted by the time we left here on that AIMC convention.
And that was, I guess, was that a dozen years ago or something?
Yeah.
It'd be a little bit more than that. Yeah.
But when I saw it, and I thought, oh, yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
And I could see where it was all coming from, what we needed to produce. And we had we had to design new speakers for it. But the first job we got was in Beirut.
Is that right?
Yeah, we had our 1570s at Dual Concentric that made it great, you know, because, you know, some of the surround speakers are a fair distance from the reference square.
Yes.
And, you know, how to make sure
you need a bit of throw.
You need a bit of throw and then the distance and, you know, how much they need a certain SPL from each surround speakers and all that sort of stuff. And they've changed their spec a little bit to make it a little bit kinder over time, and that makes sense. But yeah, we had it pretty well sorted out. I think that's embedded us into the industry as well. Because for us, it's a lot more speakers.
Because you were an earlier adopter, effectively.
I mean, Event was pretty well behind it pretty quickly.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
They were there, so and Edge was, you know, they asked us a lot of questions about it.
Yep.
And, you know, this Village installed a few.
Yeah.
So we basically went for it.
Mm. You mentioned Beirut.
Yep.
Which just twigs the thought of how many countries have you installed?
Oh, yeah, good question.
But clearly.
Lots.
15,
20, 25,
30.
Oh, 30 to 40.
Is that right?
Yeah, something like that.
Wow.
I mean, it's basically a lot of Europe, some of the US. South America, we did some work a while ago.
Yep.
I think there's something in Afghanistan, I don't know. I know that Russia, there's a few bits.
Yeah, okay.
That was a while ago. Through Europe and Germany and Norway. Norway's been a good customer of ours.
Wow.
Yeah, and the UK.
That's
Canada is a bit.
Congratulations.
And China,
I mean, that's super impressive.
Hong Kong, Japan. Yeah, yeah, not a lot.
Yeah, that's,
but you know, there's bits and pieces there. India, we've done a bit there, so that's all right.
Pretty solid market there, I guess. Yeah, and a growing
it's
market.
It's pretty fickle. Yeah,
it's a bit fickle, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Sensitive to price.
Yeah. Very, yeah. That would be a very that'll be an understatement. Should be a market.
They're going to carry on a fine tradition.
Yeah,
that's right.
But the home theatre market's doing really well for us.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a distributor over there that actually lived in Sydney for a long time.
Okay.
And he's gone back to India and opened up a distribution and a showroom.
Oh, right, yeah.
And he built himself an experience centre.
Okay.
Two stories, I think it is, and we've got the whole bottom floor.
Wow.
And it's all about our home theatre and two channel, and it's got the timeline on the wall. And
is that like in Mumbai or somewhere? Or
Chennai, I think it is.
Okay.
Yeah. Ashley's been there. I haven't been there.
Okay.
But I've met the principal.
Yep.
Yeah. But that's been a good business, and the MX and the LX have been extremely well received over there.
Well, speaking of that, so we're talking about the wall of sound, as I call it. Is that right?
Yeah, that'll be. Yep.
Well, I mean, that's a... It's a very cool looking thing. Talking about industrial design,
yes.
Before we were interrupted in the previous room and turfed out, unceremoniously, you know, like, surprised we didn't receive some kind of writ almost. I mean, well, we did receive a verbal one.
Well, we've got a verbal writ.
So it's, there was no doubt that we had to leave.
Yes, yes.
You will leave now, I'm giving you 2 minutes.
Yes.
Yeah, anyhow, right. Whatever. it's the world she lives in. It's, you will do... Yeah, we'll just leave it. Yeah. What was I talking about?
I can't remember.
No. That. Oh, the wall of sound. It's just got to be the easiest thing to sell in a way, because it's so...
Yep.
Don't take this the wrong way, but it is the Ram truck of the loudspeaker business in a way.
Yep.
It's so big and bold and...
Yep. We're talking.
I hate to use the word macho, but I mean, if you're thinking a serious home cinema system, it looks like the recipe you would
need. We're talking
need.
About the MX series.
MX. Sorry,
Modular X.
Yes. Okay. So that's what it stands for. So what's LX? Is that
Linear X?
Okay.
That's that.
That's
soundbar.
That's the giant soundbar.
Yeah,
okay.
It's not a soundbar. It's a sound experience. Make sure you get that. That's a Don McKenzie thing. That
is it? Well, it's definitely
it's not a sound.
It's not a sound bar. Sound it's more of a sound log, but I mean, it's quite enormous.
Yeah.
But so the MX, yes, is the screen filler, if you like, at least behind the screen. And so technical things. One thing. So you tailor the response of those to work with your average acoustically transparent screen, or is there not really much to that, or is there a bit of...
Generally, we prefer to see a woven screen, one of those, because they are pretty nicely acoustically transparent.
But yes.
The plastic screens, or the perforated screens...
Yeah.
It's plastic film with small holes in it.
Not so good?
Not so good.
Okay, no. So yeah, just on that. So when I'm thinking a woven screen when I think acoustically transparent. Yeah. But yeah, in the commercial cinema world, they're usually a perforated screen.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mongrel if you want to put a fire to... point on it.
So you work with that in the commercial world, but in the home cinema world, a woven acoustically transparent screen's the go.
Yes, and it's got much more even loss.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it's pretty straightforward, pretty much. It's a bit like a grill cloth.
Yeah, it's literally a heavy grill cloth. Yeah. So the perforated screen is reflection or something?
Very reflective.
Yes.
Especially the higher frequencies, and you know, it depends on the hole spacing and what gets through. It gets pretty bumpy, and off axis it gets worse, you know, because you've got that glancing effect of the sound going.
So the perforations are acting as a little bit of a lens to some degree out into the audience. And the reflection problem is that you're getting this what would you call it? It's like a standing wave effect or something. You've got something happening between the speaker and the screen.
That's... Yeah, well, that's why we put the absorptive material there.
Yeah, okay.
For the high frequency part
yes.
of it.
Yeah.
Because you get a horn, and if you're off axis, it bounces. If it was a solid wall there, for example, it'd bounce around a lot.
Mm.
So you put some absorptive material to get the first reflection off the screen.
Yes.
Done.
Okay.
There.
Yeah, all right.
So that was one of the reasons we put it there. The other one was just to quieten down the room.
Yeah.
Yeah. It made a huge difference, having just those two elements part of it.
No doubt.
Yeah.
The MX Home Cinema Wall of Sound is a spin-off of your commercial...
Pretty much.
R&D, or is it... Very specifically for the home.
Very specifically for the home, but it can be used in post-production and small cinema spaces,
mm-hmm.
especially on which one you get.
Okay.
We've got from the MX5 right up to the MX40, because
yes.
we've got a fair range now
yep.
for different rooms and different sizes,
yes.
et cetera, et cetera. But the idea was to make it a real cinema sound in that's
yep.
relatively affordable. Now,
well, it kind of is, isn't it? I mean, it's...
Well, it is, yeah, I think so. Now, what had happened is that we did an install for somebody in Toorak, and I put the commercial speakers in it because they work.
Yeah.
And we've tried to build the infinite baffle around it.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of work, you know.
Is this where the MX started, effectively?
And then they're like, yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
And you think, well, hang on a minute. We have the X series, which is virtually that, and you build the baffle, and it's, you know, you've got to get trades on board and
yes, yep.
put the absorptive material in, and the speakers don't fit all that well, and
no.
blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So we thought, well, basically, wouldn't it be just easier once we've got more into the home cinema type market and we're more involved in perhaps the installation, is to just make a modular system.
To sort of match the size of a screen.
Pretty much. There's your screen.
Yep.
You know, got different sizes. We make spaces.
Yep.
To fit screen sizes. And so the left and rights are pretty well right out to the extremities.
Yep.
And then we have some spaces that go in between the mids or the subs.
Yes.
So essentially it's the whole package.
Baffle pieces, effectively.
That's right. And it's got the absorptive part at the front. As well as, so it does all of it all in one.
Yeah, okay.
And it's pretty easy to install.
Yes.
And so the dealers like doing that.
And well, you seem to have done very well with that product.
Oh, absolutely.
And export wise.
Yeah, especially in India.
Okay.
India's been one of our biggest markets for the
MX. For that particular product, yeah.
Because
yeah.
it just beats everybody else. I mean, people have tried to
Are you
copy
sure?
It. Yeah. Yeah, I'm very
it just
sure.
beats everyone. Well, I don't think there's a lot of other. There's not a lot of other products quite like it.
Yeah, well, Clips tried it. And they made an absolute mess of it.
Is that right?
Yeah, I tried it here in Australia, but it was about twice the price and half the performance. So that's not going to work.
No, it's not.
And they claimed they did all this intensive research. I thought, oh yeah, they just copied us, right?
That was intensive. Their intensive research was looking at your website.
Yeah, they looked at us. Oh, no, the Clips people were looking at our display in the Cedia in Amsterdam.
Okay.
And we had it over there.
Yeah.
And the Clips people were coming down and looking.
Hanging around.
Didn't take
photos. Making notes.
Right. They make one. Yeah, that's right.
So
pretty interesting, really.
Hey now, hi-fi. Jeff Haynes runs a fantastic boutique hi-fi store in Melbourne, but has an online presence that I guess spans the globe. It's Black Friday. Jeff is having a sale. Now, why would you go and check it out? Because it's different. Like everything Jeff does, it's a bit different. Have a look now. heynowhifi.com.au. Black Friday sale on now.
And we're back with Scott. And we are going to talk hi-fi for a second.
Yay.
How are we going with batteries? We're going fine. The Exoterics.
Yes.
It's probably your statement hi-fi piece in a way.
Yep.
It's certainly the most unique thing you've probably made in the hi-fi side.
Yep.
I think it looks uber cool. It's been around for a while. It continues.
That's right. Yep, it continues, yes.
And it's... can you tell us a little bit about... People should go to the website. We'll probably put a picture up on our website.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because it's got a couple of things going on. It's got this... free range, not flush mounted waveguide arrangement for the tweeter.
Yep.
It looks, of course, like a horn, and I guess it is in a way.
It's actually a waveguide.
What's the difference between a waveguide and a horn, do you think?
Well, horn's actually just a... well, it needs a compression driver.
Mm.
And the output impedance, essentially, in short words, of the compression driver is actually... needs to see a high impedance load.
Okay.
So it transfers energy a lot more efficiently if the throat of the horn matches it.
Okay.
So it's an impedance matching device.
Yes.
And that's what basically transforms very small vibrations
into lots, and then it reduces
in, at higher pressure and then transforms that to lower pressure, higher SPL sort of.
So that's a transformer. So probably, there's probably a lot of people who don't fully understand that everyone who loves a bit of hi-fi probably has heard the expression compression driver.
Yes. Yes.
So while we're on the subject, so what's the real difference between, say, a compression driver and just a normal soft dome tweeter?
Well, usually the dome of the compression driver is made out of metal.
Yeah.
And it's in a fairly intense magnetic field, and it's got a phase plug arrangement that transfers the energy into a smaller neck.
Yep.
And that, the aperture, and then that sits on a horn.
Yes.
And that... it has to be basically a horn, or an exponential horn, or a constant directivity horn. Or
so the compression driver is sort of loading a space, hence the expression compression, I guess.
Yes.
And then it expands out via the horn.
Yes, that's right.
Obviously, none of that happens with a soft dome. That's and then right. in turn...
The soft dome would never work on a horn, essentially, because the impedance of the throat of the horn is not matched to the dome.
No.
It just doesn't fit. But essentially what a waveguide does is just essentially guides the wave.
Yeah, to the clue is in the title.
It increases the sensitivity on axis. It actually reduces the dispersion to control it.
By effectively, I guess, narrowing the dispersion, it's got the same amount of SPL, but over a smaller radiation area.
It squeezes it to a much more
control. Increases the sensitivity, obviously.
That's exactly right.
So, and that's what you wanted to do.
Yep.
I don't understand, and we probably don't need to, but I mean, I'm not sure who came up with the industrial design or the idea for that loudspeaker.
Well, it was a combination of Dave Murphy, our horn waveguide specialist, and John Scott, our industrial design guy.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, a melding of minds.
A melding of minds, yes, it was quite good.
So with Dave you standing in the background poking them.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I want it to look.
We'd taser them.
I want it to be tasers. I want it to look cool.
Yeah, well, Johnny just came up with it.
Yeah, okay.
And I looked at it and thought, fucking hell. And it was in a different box.
Yep.
But then we listened to it. Because it's the Revelator tweeter.
Oh, it's a Revelator tweeter.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, it goes
so
up
a serious
to,
tweeter.
You know, from DC to light, just about that one.
And I want to jump in and say, it's a waveguide, and it was before the fashion of waveguides.
That's right.
I mean, it was. I mean, it's been around for 15 years, is it?
Yeah, probably not quite that long, but in that
10 or 12, though. Right?
Yeah, it'd be something like that. Mm.
I think
something like that. Okay.
The waveguide fashion started.
Oh, that was millions of years. We did the waveguide, you know, surround speaker years ago because we needed to put that X curve on a surround.
Yep.
So we just sculpted the front baffle, an 80mm front baffle, and put a bevel on it.
Yep.
And that lifted the lower frequency, lower part of the high frequency, sort of about 500 or 600 to 1K, lifted that by four or five dB, I can't remember, and then it rolled off nicely.
Yep.
So essentially it was waveguide-y to about 3K.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it was a little bit more... omnidirectional from after that. So that got that acoustic curve. So we did a waveguide for that.
So that's donkey's years ago.
That was donkey's years. That was 23 years ago.
So yet again, you beat everyone.
Yes. I think it's been around for a million years. It's just come fashionable.
Well, I mean, you could talk fashion for a second. Yeah. I mean, there is so much fashion in the hi-fi business.
It's worse.
And like a lot of fashion in the clothing world, things come back.
They do.
And
they
horns...
Do.
are back.
Yep,
they never went away for you, but they are back in domestic order.
Yep,
big drivers are back.
Yep.
Big baffles are back.
Yep. Yeah, they are back.
I want to say they're back. A lot of people are probably more interested in the 70s and 80s, you know, JBLs and things like that. But but there is a few new makers of them as well.
Yep.
There's some that never went away. You can think of, say, Harbeth have always made a whopping great 12-inch three-way thing.
Yep.
Nothing's changed. They're sort of a spin-off of a BBC design, I guess. But, I mean, it is the 70s coming back.
Yeah.
But it's not just that. It's in other things as well.
Yeah.
But we'll go back to the esoterics. I'm probably jumping around a bit. But I like to... I mean, it's... The thing is, my point is, what I'm getting at, is that these were good ideas then. They remain good ideas now. It's just fashion. I've had a guy swearing at me on the YouTube comments the other day that there's no way that loudspeaker could image, because I might have put words in my marketing team's mouth about the wide baffle loudspeaker designer we were speaking to at the time.
Yeah.
I think he had said actually how well they image. And this guy's keyboard warring away, there's no way a wide baffle can image. Well, what logic is that? I mean, that was the marketing spin on a narrow baffle, the 90s narrow tall floor standards, was that they imaged better.
Yeah.
In your mind, they could image better. Just but of course, it's got nothing to do with it, though, does it?
Oh, it's just the acoustic.
If you control the diffraction, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what? There's millions of ways of getting it to image properly.
Yes.
And I think sometimes with waveguides or controlled dispersion is really a good way to get it to image properly.
Yes.
And I think it's all about how the loudspeaker dispersion characteristics work.
How linear they are across the band?
Because it should be pretty well constant all the way through.
Yes.
And the one thing is about the esoteric Ultims is that you've got a 6.5-inch bass driver and the dispersion pattern matches the tweeter.
Yeah.
Thanks to the waveguide.
Yes.
At the crossover. And it stays pretty well like that all the way through.
Yeah.
So you get the constant amount of energy in the room. Doesn't change much.
No.
And that's really where horn systems are the same in a lot of rooms, is that you know exactly where it's going to be. And it doesn't go off the walls. The energy in the room remains constant.
Yep.
And you get the sound where you want it, and it doesn't change.
No.
You know? No. Mm. I mean, THX did that millions of years ago. They wanted a first order relationship between the real low frequency and when it got to the higher mid bass.
Yeah, okay.
And so that was a first order matching, and then it was basically consistent all the way up.
Yeah, right.
This is in the horizontal plane. Hmm.
THX.
And that makes sense. That makes sense. Not like sex, it makes sense.
It may make
sense. Yeah, it could. It probably did.
Certainly horns and sex
have they do. But
so what, from a number of different angles.
You're digging a bigger hole here.
I am. I might just stop talking. THX, no one talks about it much anymore, but really I think they had a lot of good ideas. Do you think that they did?
I think they did. They actually, it's interesting because our Infinite Baffle, we produced that in, I think the first one's about 1980.
Mm.
But they introduced the Infinite Baffle in commercial cinema around 82, 83, 84.
Yep.
But we'd already done a few by that time. So there was a little bit of a contest. But essentially it boiled down that, we just continued doing it. But we got to know the THX tech people pretty well.
Yep, okay.
We went out to the... to Skywalker Ranch.
To the ranch.
To the ranch. Yep. And had a look at that and their Foley cinemas and, post production stuff. And that was a really good relationship that we ended up doing. And we got a lot of THX approval in our commercial cinemas.
Yeah, okay.
And we were the first people in the world to get our four way speakers THX approved. And we also the first people to do a dual 18 inch subwoofer in commercial cinema. Everybody's using single 18s, and I thought, what's the point? Because you're going to use two, you might as well put in one box, it's a bit more efficient.
Well, it is. Yeah.
And then we got away from foam surrounds because we knew that was going to fall apart.
Yes.
And so we redesigned it with a textile surround and all that sort of stuff, which wasn't hard to do, but it was just somebody did it,
So you, we are jumping around a bit, but I like it. We'll come back to the esoterics, although I think we covered the fact that it's it's constant directivity.
Yeah.
You know, it's a look it up, folks. It's it's a cool looking little thing.
Yeah. It's a lovely sounding speaker. You can listen to it forever. And it's interesting, the people that buy it are people, there's a lot of people in the wine industry I know well.
Yeah.
And they have it. And I have to plug, but it's in the Penfolds VIP tasting room.
Is it? Is it really?
Yes, we supplied the system.
I haven't been there for a few weeks, I'd forgotten. Yeah, I've never been invited into the VIP tasting room.
Maybe we'll take you in there.
I've only been to Penfolds, I think, twice in my life anyhow.
But, that's right.
And it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Speaking of Penfolds, you did tell me once.
Oh, right, okay. Oops.
Now we are jumping around. But why not? You've mentioned Penfolds.
Yep.
You maybe help them out sometimes?
Yeah, we help them out, yeah.
With
we let them know how, we help them sell into China, of course. No, we, because I have a foot in the grape growing business, I have a relationship with Penfolds.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and it's been pretty good.
Do you know where which bottles your grapes end up in?
Yeah, I've got a pretty good idea.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't remember the numbers.
No, but it's a 3-digit number of some sort, I guess.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah. But it's not a one word.
No.
It's not Grange.
We do produce the 389 and St Henri and Grange.
Is that right?
We get our fruit into.
389's a good drink.
It's 389's got, I like St Henri.
I like it all, actually, kind of thing.
yours worse than me. I got into it because I like wine. It's as simple as that. And I got to know some very interesting people in the industry.
No,
they are sensory people. And that's
there's a lot of parallels, isn't there?
Yeah, that's right. And these people, you know, the chief winemaker, for example, you know, his palate is absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
But he loves his music. He knows all the musicians and all that sort of stuff.
Is that right? Yeah, okay. Yeah. Is this how the loudspeakers ended up in the tasting room?
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
Because Penfolds, I don't know if this is the other term, but they weren't particularly interested in actually financing a decent sound system.
And they
weren't. I said, look, mate, we'll lend it to you.
Okay.
Forever.
Yeah, rightio.
It's ours.
Yeah.
And we'll just lend it to you.
Okay.
So we got a colour that was very close to the Penfolds red. They wouldn't let us know have it, but they'd give us a pretty good idea of what red it was. So we did it in gloss.
Yep.
And put the Electra amplifiers in.
Yeah, okay.
And the processing required and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, rightio.
So they've got a nice sound system for their people. And that was really nice. The relationship's been quite strong like that. I mean, it's just a nice thing to do.
It is a nice thing to do.
And they were they let us sort of brag about it, so that's pretty cool.
It is.
But there's another thing that happened,
which
you might be interested in, is that I got this phone call one day, I think it was on a Friday, and one of the grape liaison officers says, oh, can we come down? Grape liaison officer. He was a chief.
Yeah.
And he says, oh, can we come out? I've got a visitor from America.
Yeah.
And can we just drop down and see your vineyard? You know, he's interested in grapes. I said, fair enough. So I said, when are you then? Oh, about an hour. I said, all right, fair enough, I'll see you there. Okay, that's cool. So turn up, chief winemaker's there, Peter Gago and a few other people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this American. I said, okay. And he introduced himself as Kona, what's his main? What's Tool's name again? Maynard Keaton? Keaton? Tool's. The Tool lead singer for Tool.
Oh, for Tool. I don't know.
Maynard.
I know how he sounds.
Yeah, Maynard. This is a bit embarrassing, really. But I got introduced to this guy.
So that's who it was then?
Yeah.
Wow.
And I said, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. I said, he's a dude. Yeah, he's American. That's fine. He had a nice girlfriend. Yeah, good.
You didn't notice?
No, I didn't know. So and Pete says, oh, he's the lead singer for Tool. I said, oh, yeah, that's good. Yeah, anyway, talk about vines and grapes. And the other thing that happened, I've got this dog, and it found some dogs, so it's busy rolling in dog stuff.
No.
That's canine Chanel 5. So we had a quite an interesting discussion about grapes. He just loves that sort of stuff. I didn't even know who he was.
You probably had heard some of the music unintentionally, not realising, but they my attention was drawn to them they had this amazing film clip about, I guess, 20 years ago.
Yep.
With all this sand in it and stuff. It's I can't even hardly remember how it goes now. Yep. And it was a great piece of music. And I'm not particularly into heavy rock.
Yep.
But, or metal, as I guess.
Yeah, pretty much.
Borderline on. But they're a bit better than that. I mean, they're... the album we use occasionally at shows, and that is, you know, it's very interesting stuff. Beautifully recorded as well. He certainly must have an interest in great sound.
Yep.
Because they have very high production values. You know.
They do.
Yeah, there's not just some raucous 70s pommy shit recording.
Yep.
It's beautifully made.
Yeah,
beautifully made music.
Yep.
So yeah, that's up. Let's talk celebrities for a second.
Yeah, I just want to go further with that one.
Sure.
I went
it
up.
It gets better.
Yeah, it does get better because you know, son Tim comes home. He drove past, and I was with him. And I went up to him and said, "Oh, this Maynard guy from Tool. Do you know anything about it?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm going to go and see him tonight.
Oh,
there's a concert."
Oh, shit.
And I said, "Oh, yeah, well, he was here just then."
What?
What?
So we just left.
We're still talking to Tim and gone home. He said, "You could have met him." And then I talked to the people at work, and they'll never forget it. Anyway, that was just something you'd do. And I guess Peter, the great the winemaker.
Yeah.
Like I said, he loves his music. He's a very, you know, he's a sensory type of guy.
Yeah.
And you know, he gets to know these people really well. You know.
I guess they're high level customers or something.
They go to the VIP rooms, and they might. I think Maynard would drink a bottle of Grange while he's singing. You know, he's got it in the background. That's how it works.
Yep.
Yeah. Just, yeah. No, and Pete shows me the people that he bumps into all over the world. So.
The Hi-Fi Shop is the home of quality hi-fi. Experience the best of everything from affordable turntables to not-so-affordable high-end loudspeakers. Let Alex curate a complete system for you, or have him using his technical background assist with your next upgrade. Visit in person or check the website hifishop.com.au for easy information on all of your favourite brands. Go straight to the top, speak to Alex at Hi-Fi Shop.
Now, I think your ears tend to fill up the bits.
It's so much like it's wine tasting, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's it. Exactly.
I mean, it's
both sensory stuff.
And the reason why I mention this is it comes full circle back to the hi-fi enthusiast.
Yep.
And not having a crack at them.
Yep.
It's just there are things perhaps more at play than just maybe balance. Although, I agree, I think balance is really important.
Yep.
In fact, maybe what I should just ask is, what do you think is the number one thing to get right with a loudspeaker design, perhaps? Is it balance? Is it smoothness of response? Not necessarily a linear response, but or is it headroom? Is it dynamics? Is it bass extension? Is it...
Keep going.
So it's all of these things.
Basically, yeah. You're doing well.
Well... You know, it's got to look cool as well.
Oh, mate. Oh, yeah, it's got to look cool. Yeah.
Well, that gets back to the wine thing. So hi-fi that looks better sounds better, right?
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, there's an element of that. And that's some of the things, because we tend to be a bit form and function. But, you know, you've got to stick it in a living room and people want it to look like
that. That's right.
Or your man cave, there's a bit of a different
fish. But even if it's going in a man cave, it's got to look... It's got to have the right look, which clearly your commercial cinema speakers do. They have that look.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, for audiophile people, it depends on who they are and what they listen to. But some people that enjoy music, they'll just enjoy lots of different ones. And I'm in that class because I just...
Different music or different systems?
Different systems.
Oh, I think you've got to have two systems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've kind of... always had two, I guess. You've got the very informative, accurate one.
Yeah.
And the more one along the lines we're talking about, with the mellowness and the late night sort of...
Yeah. It's sort of like port and a fire.
There's a little bit of that, isn't there? Yeah.
Yeah, there
to continue the wine... sort of characterisation.
Yeah, just then you just slide out. Yeah, 6DB roll off. Or 3DB after midnight.
That's right. On that note, it's lunchtime and we need to crack a bottle of wine.
Oh, I think you're right.
Scott, thank you so much for your time.
That's a pleasure. We could go on for another couple of days.
Oh, yeah, no, it's. I'll wrap it up. I feel like in the future there's a chat. I'll have to think about some more detailed and focused questions.
Yes.
Rather than this rambling conversation that has been thoroughly enjoyable.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of the convention.
Thank you for having
us. And I'll see you. Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. And I'll see you at the next, some event somewhere.
Look forward to part two or the sequel or the prequel. Depends on which way you want to
look. Well, depends what we talk about. But this episode will go up soon, so I guess it'll be the sequel.
Well, look, I've actually enjoyed talking with you about this.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a laugh.
You see, we know. We've recorded it.
Unfortunately, I think we might have the same attitude towards it.
There's a little bit of that.
Yeah.
I think it comes with doing it for a long time.
Yeah, I think so.
Yes.
Yeah, and don't take it too seriously. And I think that's...
No, folks, don't take it too seriously. No. I mean, but really, the whole thing is about fun at the end of the day and music.
Absolutely.
I think that's what we believe in and probably take it slightly less seriously than...
Yeah. Well, I think
not all the time. When you're knuckling down on something, you're super serious, but the rest of the time.
Yeah.
All righty. Thank you, Scott. Thank you again. And we'll talk very soon.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Bye.
Yep.